You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the UW-Madison Plant Breeding and Genetics Program got new funding in the new federal spending bill. We'll learn more about the program itself and how the new facility would help grow it. Now, March is one of the 2 months out of the year, along with September, when conditions are ideal to see the Aurora Borealis, a.k.a. the Northern Lights, which I never have. The Northern Lights are most common in the northernmost parts of the world, Canada, Sweden, Norway, Finland, Russia, and other countries in the north. Sometimes, if you time it right, you could see the beautiful night sky phenomenon right here in the Midwest. Our next guest is going to tell us how to maximize our chances. David Eicher is the editor-in-chief of Astronomy Magazine, the author of 26 books on science and history. Dave, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me. It's very nice to be back with you.
Can you tell us what causes the Northern Lights in the first place?
Well, you know, it's a fascinating thing. The sun, of course, is a giant nuclear reactor, and it's sending out waves of particles all the time that pass us by. When there are rich areas of very excited particles, electrons and other high-energy particles that spiral down into Earth's magnetic field lines at the poles, the North and the South Pole, these particles really get energized. They get kicked up into a very excited state of energy, and they collide with oxygen and nitrogen molecules that are in our atmosphere. Anywhere generally from about 50 to about 400 miles up above the surface. And as they lose energy then after this, they kick off a photon, and that gives us this light display of greenish or sometimes even reddish or other colors light that we see in the night sky as the aurora.
Have you, I never have, as I mentioned, have you ever seen the Aurora Borealis?
I have. I've spent a lot of time under the stars. So I've seen quite a few auroral displays, and there was one actually at the end of the 1980s that was visible in Milwaukee that looked absolutely incredible. It was moving multicolors in real time. You could see it. It looked like sort of a Disney light show above your head. That was a very rare one. But even a run-of-the-mill aurora, if you will, it's really cool in the sky because most of the things in the universe are so far away that we see them as static, a single frame in a cosmic movie. But an aurora, you can actually see change its shape right in front of you over, you know, seconds and minutes. So it's really cool to see an aurora if you get the chance to see one.
Now, suppose you're an unlucky Midwesterner who's lived his whole life in the Midwest and never managed to spot one. Say, what would such a person do to maximize their chances?
It's not a terrible place to be. Of course, there's a thing that's a ring around the poles about 10 to 20 degrees away from the magnetic poles called the auroral oval and in the north and in the south. Generally, aurorae happen around that ring, if you will. And so there are certain places, Iceland, Norway, Alaska, that are great. They're right under the auroral oval. But here is not bad to see one in the upper Midwest if there's a bright one. So one thing you can do is to keep your eye on some websites that give real-time predictions of the activity of the sun. One of them, for example, is spaceweatherlive.com. If you want to go to the Space Weather Prediction Center of NOAA, the governmental agency, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, Space Weather Prediction Center, they have real-time predictions on when aurorae might be very active because of the sun's activity. And the main thing here in the Midwest is you want to get away from city lights so you have a reasonably dark sky away from the cities. That'll help you. And if you face to the north, and especially when we know the sun is active and it's getting more active over the coming years here, if you look about halfway up toward straight up and you're looking more or less toward the north, that's going to be where you want to look in the sky to see an aurora.
We've got a caller. Jeff in Berry Mills is with us. Jeff, hi.
Hi, I'm Rob. I just wanted to relate a couple events. I remember one, and I'm 70 years old. I remember one in the 50s when I was still real young, that the sky was just like it was on fire. And another one happened, I think, sometime in the mid to late 70s. And you could see the Northern Lights from where I was north of La Crosse right up until the sun washed them out in the morning. And they were so bright. And I just wondered if that fell in the 11-year cycle, you know, that they talk about.
Jeff, I know where Barry Mills is. Maybe I'll go there next time I want to try to see the light. Sounds like you've got good luck. David, that 11-year cycle, could those ones Jeff have seen in the 50s and 70s been part of that?
Absolutely, yes. And at any time, we can get a bit of a burst of activity from the sun. But of course, during the high point of that 11-year cycle of solar activity is the best time of all for action from the sun. Of course, we're actually coming up on that. The sun is getting more active now, and in 2026, it'll be at a maximum during that cycle. So the coming few years are going to be good. And when the sun is really active, it sounds like what our caller saw, there's a thing that is a belch of energy that's much bigger than it normally is always flowing out toward us that's called a coronal mass ejection. And that's what gives us a really bright aurora like the caller experience. So you can find out when a coronal mass ejection has just happened. Then about 2 days or so later, there's a very good chance for a great aurora in the sky.
And thanks for that call. David, I mentioned at the outset, March is supposed to be, I read somewhere, March is supposed to be a pretty good month to see the aurora borealis. Is that true?
Yeah, you know, it is a good month, and it's just, you know, the weather's getting warmer and the axial tilt of Earth is favorable. And, of course, it has to do more with the actual activity of the sun, which is not tied to a specific month. But it's generally a good season, and we, you know, have the opportunity to get out there and to look. So this is a good time. And, again, I would stress, you know, listeners to go to those websites mm-hmm. that can give real predictions of when the sun is sending us a burst of energy.
Dave, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for sharing this with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
David Eicher is editor-in-chief of Astronomy Magazine, author of 26 books on science and history. He joined us to talk about how to maximize our chances of seeing the northern lights. One more tip. Make sure you're far away from me. Anytime I'm anywhere where I'm going to see cool night sky stuff, I guarantee heavy, heavy cloud cover. Don't be near me. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Mary Kate McCoy with a story about composting at UW-Milwaukee.
UW-Milwaukee students have been helping turn food waste into nutrient-rich soil. A new program called Panther Pails is connecting those food scraps to the composting operations at the Sandberg Gardens Hoop House. Jessica Gatso brings you the story.
Pineapple tops, orange peels, and onion skins lay scattered in mounds of wood chips. We're inside the Sandberg Gardens Hoop House. It resembles a greenhouse, but the steel structure covered in translucent plastic is more of a tunnel. A large bin outside holds black pails with yellow covers, UWM's school colors. They're filled with coffee grounds, vegetable scraps, and eggshells waiting to become soil nutrients.
I just wish more people knew that it existed. No one knows that the Hoop House really exists, let alone the Panther Pail program.
That's Nina Hartwig from UWM's Office of Sustainability. She manages gardening and compost operations, including one called Panther Pails. This program gives students and staff an opportunity to participate in composting without needing to make their own.
The reason we started the Panther Pails is because when the pandemic hit, we weren't getting any food scraps at all. So we had to kind of find a way to generate some. So we kind of just turned to our UWM community to see if they could help us out, and they are more than excited about the program, and we actually have 70 people signed up so far since launching last year in November, and we've collected, I think, like 350 gallons of food waste from them.
It's actually a lot of fun, you know. You get to get a little dirty sometimes and, you know, turn the piles, and it's really satisfying seeing your work actually become something.
Ian Gallagher is a senior studying biology and conservation and environmental science. He's one of two student workers at the Hoop House. Food scraps are excellent nitrogen sources, but a compost pile also needs carbon. Hartwig says they supply that element by adding equal amounts of wood chips as they do food waste. Gallagher pointed out how the wood chips become rounded and softer after going through composting. It's similar to how water breaks down the sharp edges of rocks, creating smooth stones over time. Workers turn the piles every 2 weeks. This adds air and generates heat. The overturned concoction of plant matter looks charred as if a fire had been burning. But Hartwig says that ash-like appearance is actually millions of microorganisms.
They're the real people who do the job.
Most of the heat is at the top of the pile, you know, because the heat rises, obviously. And then as it kind of ages a little bit and starts to cool down a little bit, the center holds most of the heat. The top and the sides really cool down. So it's interesting to see what the pile's doing. It feels like a living and breathing organism.
The air inside the hoop house feels at least a few degrees warmer than outside. This doesn't seem surprising once you realize how much heat an active compost pile generates. Another student employee stuck a specialized composting thermometer into one of the piles. The needle moved right before our eyes, reaching a green-colored zone. That green area represents the ideal composting range of between 90 and 130 degrees Fahrenheit.
I think composting is really important, especially just to get the nutrients back into the soil. Sending food waste off to landfill and having it never break down and having none of the nutrients ever go back into our soil systems is a real issue, actually. So being able to help the soil get its nutrients back and to grow great produce is, I think, really important.
One of the final steps in the composting process involves sifting a pile through a sieve to remove the wood chips.
And then we'll reuse the wood chips and put them in new piles. Because I already have all the good microorganisms all over them, so it kind of helps jumpstart the other one that we are making. So,
the entire process takes 6 to 7 months before soil can be used on campus.
Composting at home is actually a lot easier than you think, especially if you have a resource. You'd be surprised at the amount that you get rid of and how you don't have to take your trash out as often if you're composting.
UW-Milwaukee student Jessica Gatzo brought us that story on campus composting. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org. I'm Mary Kate McCoy.
Coming up, a UW-Madison horticulture professor talks with us about the work of the university's plant genetics and breeding program and what a new federal facility would do to enhance their work. That's next here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Just under a week ago, President Biden signed the new federal spending package into law. Among the Wisconsin-specific funding items, $40 million for a new plant germplasm facility for the UW Plant Breeding and Plant Genetics Program. What does that mean? Erwin Goldman is a professor of horticulture at UW-Madison and a trainer in the UW Graduate Program for Plant Breeding and Plant Genetics. Erwin, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me, Rob.
Can you give us, in a nutshell, what you do there at the Plant Breeding and Plant Genetic Program?
Well, the program is one of the premier places for training students in plant breeding and plant genetics in the United States. I think we train more students than any other graduate program. We also have a very strong relationship with farmers and the seed industry and plant breeders all over the world who are interested in using raw germplasm to develop new strains of crops.
And let's talk about that word, germ plasm. We think different things. We hear germ and plasma, and they don't really quite fit. What is germ plasm?
Right. Great question. You know, germ plasm is sort of the raw material of what the plant breeder does. It's like choosing the parents for a cross, trying to choose a parent that has these good traits and crossing it with a parent that has some other good traits to try to produce a better strain. And plant breeding is all about trying to improve the strains of crops for farmers and for consumers and for industry, whoever uses the crop. So the germplasm is sort of like our raw resource that we use to do that work.
What are some of the different characteristics in food crops that your crew might be working on to get better crops out of them?
Yeah, well, you know, I would say disease resistance, pest resistance, drought resistance, flavor traits, nutrition, yield, other traits that might be beneficial to farmers. These are just some of the traits that plant breeders work with. And I think it's a very collaborative sort of enterprise because one has to talk with the people who are growing the crops, the people who are processing the crops, the people who are eating the crops to try to find out which traits are of most importance. And so usually the plant breeder has a long list of things that they want to improve.
Could you talk about the kinds of techniques you use? Because I could picture anything from, what's the monk, Gregor Mendel, you know, carefully crossing this pea plant with that pea plant, or, you know, CRISPR high-tech genetic editing technology and all points in between.
Right. Well, there is a huge set of tools now that can be used by the plant breeder. But I would say, in the main, most of the work that goes on in our plant breeding program on campus is mostly conventional breeding, classical breeding. That's been going on for thousands of years. with some sophisticated tools that might allow us to use DNA markers, for example, to be more efficient in our selection of traits. There is a bit of genetic engineering and the CRISPR gene editing type of work that you mentioned, but I would say the bulk of the work really focuses around the sort of traditional field-oriented plant breeding that's been a mainstay for centuries.
We're talking to Erwin Goldman, horticulture professor at UW-Madison, about the plant breeding and plant genetics program there and some new funding for a plant germplasm facility. Now, let's talk about that, Erwin. There's this funding from the new big federal spending bill that people might have heard about. What is that going to go toward?
Right. So one of the things that people may not know about our work at UW-Madison is that we have a really strong partnership with the United States Department of Agriculture. And the USDA has placed a number of their scientists in Madison, co-located them with us on campus to sort of increase the critical mass of people doing the work of plant breeding and curating these germplasm resources. So this is a new federal facility, this will be, and we, because of our close partnership with the federal scientists, hope that the university will also be able to benefit from it. And in that way, I think we have a really excellent collaborative environment between state and federal scientists, all of whom are interested in advancing crop genetics.
With the work you do, you mentioned you can't do it all in the lab. You have to go out and plant stuff in fields, work with farmers. Do we see your work at work around the state?
Yeah, my lab is probably typical of many in the plant breeding program. I think last summer we worked at 7 different farms across the state, all the way from the La Crosse area all the way up to Green Bay. So we do a lot of driving. We try to test our materials in different soil types and on different farms. And we have wonderful farmer collaborators with whom we do this work. And I think this is probably one of the most typical parts of plant breeding, is that it has to be done outside. It has to be done in the field, in places that the farmers do their work. And so if you go to the grocery store and you buy potatoes or carrots or onions or cucumbers, you will almost certainly be buying varieties that have touched the work of scientists at UW-Madison.
How big a factor is climate change and anticipating what that's going to mean for the future of agriculture in the work you do?
You know, this is a huge part of why germplasm is so important, because as the climate changes, as it gets hotter or drier or wetter in different parts of the world, we have to go back into the vaults of seed and the genetic resources that would be located in a facility like this and continue to breed for the kinds of environments that farmers face. And so germplasm and maintaining germplasm is so critical to meet the needs of whatever those are going to be for climate change.
Yeah, you mentioned that vault. Are you, in effect, going to have a new archive of plant genetic material now?
Yeah, you know, right now, the plant breeding program, both state and federal scientists are storing their seeds and curating their seeds in very antiquated facilities. Some of those facilities are over 100 years old, and they don't meet modern standards. By building this new lab, not only will there be cold storage space for seeds and propagules like tubers and roots and other things that need to be stored, but there will be labs for modern analysis of that material. And so part of the work is sort of curating these seeds, curating this germplasm, and part of it is characterizing it so that other people can make more efficient use of it.
I know many gardeners are familiar with heirloom varieties of different vegetables in particular. Is that part of your work, going back to, you know, some of the variety of veggies that we might not see at the grocery store and seeing, hey, is there stuff there that might help us meet these different demands?
Absolutely. I mean, in modern science and modern breeding in the last century, we've certainly had to set aside some of those heirloom materials. There is a huge move to go back to that material and find useful traits that we may have missed along the way. And so that's yet another reason why collections and gene banks and seed banks like this are important. We don't know what traits we're going to need in the future. We don't know what challenges we're going to face. And so some of those heirlooms may actually be key to the kind of breeding we may be doing in the future.
If there are farmers or maybe even gardeners listening, are there ways they can get involved and be planting some of the crops you're working on?
Definitely. And, you know, many Wisconsinites will be familiar with the network of agriculture research stations that the university operates in the College of Agricultural and Life Sciences. They're spread around the state. We hold field days at those locations where you can see the breeding material and you can interact with the plant breeders and the other scientists who are doing this work. And a lot of times the experimental gardens will be holding those materials. And so I think for people who are interested in this, I would say the local agricultural research stations would be a good place to do that. We're also certainly glad to host people who visit. And we do have one of the premier sites for seeing some of this material, the West Madison Ag Research Station in Madison, where the facility will be located, is another excellent garden where you can see this material.
In just our last few moments, is there a plant that you or some of your students are working on that you're particularly excited about right now?
Well, the one that has really captivated me over the last 30 years that I've been working here is the table beet. And I think a lot of people think of table beets as sort of a humble peasant food, but they're having a bit of a moment out there, and beets have become very, very popular in the United States and in many parts of Europe. In fact, they are increasing in popularity almost everywhere, partly because they're viewed as a nutritional star, but also because I think they're beautiful and they have a lot of interesting flavors to deliver. And our program happens to be one of the few in the United States that is curating the genetic resources for beet. So we're holding on to those and hoping they have value for the world.
Erwin, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Erwin Goldman is a professor of horticulture at UW-Madison, a trainer in the UW graduate program for plant breeding and plant genetics. We talked to him today about some of the work and contributions of the breeding and genetics program and how a new federal facility is going to help further those efforts. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, political disinformation isn't new, but it flies around faster than ever in the social media world. We'll check out the problem and possible solutions with the author of the book Cheap Speech: How Disinformation Poisons Our Politics and How to Cure It. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we find out why the Biden administration may extend the pandemic freeze on student loan payments. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. The Pentagon says it's seeing clear evidence that war crimes are being committed by Russian forces in Ukraine. Spokesperson John Kirby says the department continues to see indiscriminate attacks on civilians that, in many cases, are intentional.
There's no justification for it, so I'm not even going to try to do that. But clearly, they are causing increased numbers of civilian casualties.
It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Wisconsin faces a shortage of nurses. We'll find out how we got here and look at some ideas for turning things around. First, student loan repayments have been on pause for a couple years now because of the pandemic. Now the Biden administration has signaled that it may extend that pause, which was set to expire in May. White House Chief of Staff Ron Klain also said that President Biden will decide whether to forgive some student loan debt before that freeze is lifted. Here's Klain on the show Pod Save America.
The president's going to look at what we should do on student debt before the pause expires, or he'll extend the pause. And so the question of whether or not there's some executive action student debt forgiveness when the payments resume is a decision we're going to take before the payments resume.
We're talking now about student loan debt and the possible continuation of the repayment moratorium. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is this you? Have your student loan repayments been on hold for a while? Do you want to see that continue, or do you think it's time to get back to normal on that? What questions do you have? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Travis Hornsby is a chartered financial analyst and founder of studentloanplanner.com. He hosts the Student Loan Planner podcast. Travis, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob.
So for people who have their student loan payments frozen right now, that might end in May, It might not. What should they be doing right now?
We don't think it's going to end in May. We think they will probably extend it. In terms of what people should do, it's been a long time since you've heard from your student loan company, right? So what we would recommend is to try to go into your servicer's website and update your contact information. You can also do that at studentaid.gov. Just make sure that when the payment pause inevitably does end, that you have everything on file so that somebody can reach you and let you know about the details for whatever that will be.
Did people have the option of continuing payments to try to, tuck away at the principal there?
Yeah, you certainly do during this pause, and a lot of people have done that. But in many cases, it's a mistake. And the reason for that is because some people go for student loan forgiveness programs. And if you're making any payments during this period that we've had the pause in place for the past 2 years, if you're going for student loan forgiveness, then those payments are wasted. And one thing that people aren't aware of is you can actually request a retroactive refund going back to the beginning of the pause, March 13th of 2020, and get all that money back if you mistakenly paid when you didn't need to. Of course, some people that do want to pay off their debts in full are continuing to make payments. And with the interest being paused, all that's going towards what people owe, which is a very welcome thing. But I think it will unfortunately end, but it's going to, I think, last a little bit longer than May.
Now, this freeze started during the earlier days of the pandemic under the Trump administration. The pandemic isn't over, but the damage to the economy that it was doing earlier on does seem to have faded. Can you talk about why the freeze on student loan repayments is still going on?
At this point, it's really a question of politics. So earlier on in the pandemic, everyone sort of was on the same page that we needed to do as much as possible to stimulate consumer demand. And the current administration actually did say repeatedly that the January 31st date for the end of the student loan pause would be the final extension of the pause. But what's really important to know is that coincided with two things: Omicron variant and Build Back Better not passing. And there was an overwhelming pressure campaign from the progressive wing of the Democratic Party to extend that to, I think that many have wanted extended it longer than May. The administration said that they would do it for an additional 90 days. But the problem we're running up against now is the midterm season is fast approaching. And for very obvious reasons, the party in power does not want to turn on student loan repayments for millions of borrowers going into a midterm election year. So there's some people, we would probably be among them, saying that we expect that that pause might get extended until right past the midterms to avoid political damage.
Another question all along has been not just delaying payments due, but forgiving some level of student loan debt. And the amount, depending on who's calling for it, varies from all of it everywhere to targeted amounts for people in particular need. What's the latest conversation on forgiving some student loan right now?
So the key thing to know is the authority for pausing all payments and interest is derived from the HEROES Act of 2003. And that says that you can do things during a national emergency so that borrowers are no worse off. But the interpretation is sort of then that you can't make borrowers way better off. In other words, that act doesn't possibly give the president the authority to cancel student loan debt, but merely to put things on pause. And there was a memo about a year ago that the Department of Education was asked to provide about the president's authority to cancel student loan debt. So for progressives on the left, they are very adamant that the president does have this authority. And so they asked for this memo from the Department of Education. That memo has been produced but heavily redacted. In other words, the White House refuses to say what its Department of Education thinks about what the president's authority to cancel student loan debt really is. And so everyone's in this sort of limbo where no one wants to turn student loan payments on to be blamed for that. And for whatever reason, they do not want to release the authority that they have based off of this memo to cancel student loan debt or not. So we're really sort of in this waiting game. What I kind of expect the outcome to be is that the party in power will continue the pause past the midterms to avoid being blamed for it, and will try to avoid the question of student debt cancellation, because I think what's the only reason that I can think of why they wouldn't publish that memo is that the memo told them something they didn't want to hear, which is to say that the president does not have the authority to cancel student loan debt via executive order.
Talking to Travis Hornsby from studentloanplanner.com, looking at a likely extension of a moratorium on student loan payments, the possibility of partial or total student loan debt cancellation. You can join in with your thoughts or questions about either of those at 800-642-1234. Let's bring out a caller now. Murta is with us in Madison. Murta, hi.
Hi. I'm very excited about the freeze of student loan debt. I am a registered nurse. I work for a public health department in our town, and I owe money for my college degree in nursing. And I'm really excited, and I hope at one point in this world, we would be able to look at eliminating and forgiving student loans for African Americans who are at least healthcare professionals, especially in light of the post-pandemic or the pandemic, the endemic that we're still in, because we work super hard and we are committed, but many times working for the government, it isn't super, super great, 100% great pay. So paying back student loans, especially with children and that kind of thing, becomes, you know, very difficult. So that's my thought on the issue. I'm very excited about the potential extension of the freeze on student loans.
Murda, thanks for the call. Travis, first of all, the idea of targeting some forgiveness to particular communities, whether low income or, as Murda mentions, by race, African-Americans hard hit by the pandemic. Before we get into healthcare professionals in particular, are those ideas that are out there?
Right. I mean, one thing that I wanted to say that's even more exciting than the prospect of a potential extension on the student loan pause is, because Murta mentioned she was a registered nurse, that everyone needs to know about the public service waiver program that's enacted right now that the Biden administration is doing. So many people might have heard about public service loan forgiveness. It's this program that infamously has had a lot of problems with the approval rate for people that are applying and get denied. So during the pandemic, with all these emergency authorities the president has over student loan debt, the Biden administration has waived most of the requirements for the PSLF program that normally exist, which means that, say, Murda had been a registered nurse for, let's just say, 15 years and had been making payments, but maybe she had the wrong kind of loans. Well, you can now consolidate those loans with the Department of Education and then apply at studentaid.gov/PSLF after that consolidation and potentially get all 10 years that you need for complete loan forgiveness on your loans applied to loans that previously didn't even qualify. And the deadline for that PSLF waiver program is October 31st of 2022. So, you know, that's something that could result in a whole lot of nonprofit or government full-time employees loans being either a lot more close to being forgiven or being immediately and completely forgiven. So we're seeing a huge number of people coming through our site right now for that opportunity. As to the question about should there be targeted forgiveness more specifically, I think yes. The problem with the PSLF, with the extension of the student loan pause is that it isn't targeted at all, right? It's a one-size-fits-all program, which means that, African-American nurse who's been working really hard during the pandemic but has a lot of student loan debt might be getting a lot less benefits than an orthopedic surgeon who has a lot more debt and therefore gets a lot more interest subsidized during this pause. So I would certainly think that it would be a great thing to target the forgiveness for those who need it most, be it on income level or people that are in default, or if you want to look at different demographic groups. And that's I think, one of the big missed opportunities of this student loan pause extension, that the relief is not more targeted.
Thanks for that call, Murda. We're talking about the possible extension of the pandemic freeze on student loan payments. Travis Hornsby stays with us, chartered financial analyst, founder of studentloanplanner.com. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you benefiting from this current freeze on student loan payments? Do you want to see that extended? Or whether you have loans or not, do you think it's time to end that waiver? And how about the idea of forgiving student loans for some particular people, for everybody, some point in between? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Travis Hornsby, chartered financial analyst, founder of studentloanplanner.com. The Biden administration is likely to extend the moratorium on student loan payments again. Currently, that moratorium expires in May. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or your questions. Renata joins us now in Lake Mills. Renata, hi.
Good afternoon. My question has to do with the moratorium and how it applies to private student loans, which seems to be going under the radar. Many private student loan companies are still requiring payments. The interest keeps accruing. Yet these private student loan companies are protected by the federal government, and these loans need to be recategorized back what they as not in the student loan category. And I would like to hear the guest's comments on that, and I'll take my comments off the air.
Renata, thanks for the call. Travis, private student loans.
Well, there's really two kinds of private student loans, really. There's the kind that is definitely 100% private, and then there's the kind that's offered from the FFEL program, the FFEL loan program. So for those that don't know, the FFEL loan program, this is mostly loans that were taken out before 2010. A lot of times these loans are owned by a commercial entity, but they're guaranteed by the government. And so there are sometimes ways that you can consolidate these older loans into a direct loan with the government and get the benefit of that 0% interest and the forgiveness options. A lot of people aren't aware of that that's an option. So that's one point. Is a whole lot of people out there that are being charged for their loans might actually be able to get that 0% interest by consolidating at studentaid.gov. The point about the private loans that are, you know, definitely not guaranteed by the government that are not on that program, unfortunately, you know, there's nothing that can be done in the short run. So if you have a private student loan, what we would suggest is try to apply for a lower interest rate. So for example, a whole lot of people have interest rates that are above 3% on their private loans. And that's one thing that studentloanplanner.com does, is we help identify for people that have private loans, can you qualify for a lower interest rate, possibly get a lower monthly payment as well. So while I sympathize that, you know, for whatever reason that those loans were left out of the conversation, there are some relief options available by potentially looking for lower interest rates or consolidating them if they're actually guaranteed by the government.
Thanks for that call, Renata. Jeremy joins us next in Milwaukee. Jeremy, hi.
How are you?
Good. What'd you want to bring up, Jeremy?
Well, I'm just thinking, like, I mean, I went to school 15 years ago. At the age of 24 years old, I decided to go to college, went to a university, and spent $75,000 in loans because I didn't have the money saved in my bank account to go to college, but I knew I wanted to go. So I took those loans out, $75,000 later, graduated, and over the course of 12 years, slowly but surely, using just logic and self-discipline, budgeting, I paid my loans off. And I feel like nowadays everybody's looking for free money, free this, free that. And it's just killing our economy. It's killing our nation. And
I gotcha, Jeremy. We don't have too much time left, but this is a lot of people think, Travis, hey, either I paid my loans off or I didn't go to college. I didn't take loans at all. So why should this one group of people get this benefit that isn't applying to everybody else?
Well, luckily, I'm not a politician, so I would urge everyone, for every different opinion that people have on student loan debt, to contact their representatives, contact their legislators, contact their representatives, senators, et cetera, to make their views known. That's the point of a democracy, right? I would say, in terms of the caller's point, you know, it is true that the, you know, student loans are disproportionately held by people that have higher incomes than average. It's true. And, you know, economists would call this sort of policy regressive, meaning that it's, you know, disproportionately benefits higher income borrowers. It's also true that there's a lot of student loan borrowers really struggling that are working single parents, that this would be absolutely life-changing to receive some level of relief. What we tell people is, you know, you can control what you can control. And at the end of the day, there's a lot of loopholes, a lot of tricks and tools that you can utilize to pay your debt off or go for forgiveness if that's a better choice for you individually. So just as we, you know, say that, you know, Social Security or Medicare, it doesn't really matter what your view is on it. If it doesn't get changed, you might as well claim the benefits that you are being offered because you're paying taxes for it anyway. So that's sort of our approach to things. And, you know, I would encourage people to pay their debt back faster than 12 years if that's the path that makes sense for them. And some of this, you know, tools you can do, like you're refinancing it to a lower interest rate, you know, maybe trying to take bonuses and throwing it at your loans and different strategies like that. So I understand where the caller is coming from and just hope everybody reaches out to the representatives to share their views.
Jeremy, thanks for sharing your story. In just our last minute, Travis, what are you watching for next on student loan debt and the federal government?
I think you're going to see a lot more headlines about this PSLF waiver for public servants specifically. About 100,000 people have been approved for this so far. I expect as many as maybe 5 to 10 million borrowers could potentially benefit from this public service loan forgiveness waiver. So if you are a nonprofit or a government employee listening to this, please Google the PSLF waiver. check out studentaid.gov. You can check out studentloanplanner.com and see if you potentially qualify for this, because it's truly a life-changing thing that expires because of the temporary authority from the pandemic, October 31st of 2022. And finally, with the student loan pause, I expect we will hear something, if not this week, then next week when the president gets back from his overseas trip.
Travis, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Great to be here.
Travis Hornsby is a chartered financial analyst and the founder of studentloanplanner.com. He talked to us about whether we'll see student loan forgiveness under President Biden as the freeze on payments, as we just heard, may soon be extended. Milwaukee residents will have a chance to participate in a historic mayoral election on April 5th. There's no incumbent on that ballot for the first time since 2004. Bob Donovan, a self-described conservative who served for years as a common council member, is facing acting Mayor Cavalier Johnson. If Johnson wins, he would be the city's first elected black mayor. Corrine Hess has more.
Johnson and Donovan were the top vote-getters in a seven-way February primary. Johnson came out on top with nearly 42% of the vote. Donovan got 22%. Only about a quarter of registered voters went to the polls in February, and now, in the weeks leading up to the general election, enthusiasm for the race hasn't seemed to increase. At the Blue Kangaroo Laundromat on Milwaukee's south side, most of the customers are unaware there is a mayor's race going on. For those who did know, many like Celio Palacio say the outcome doesn't matter much.
And I always like to read the platform of each one of the candidates. And most of the times, it just doesn't work.
Blue Kangaroo is in Bob Donovan's district, but Cavalier Johnson got 44% here, compared to Donovan's 39%. John Johnson is a research fellow at Marquette University Law School who has watched the race closely. He says despite the serious challenges the city is facing, he isn't expecting a high turnout on April 5th. The mayoral election will be the only thing on the April ballot in most parts of Milwaukee.
Turnout goes up quite a lot in the general election for mayor, but that also coincides with the presidential preference vote and often contested statewide elections for Wisconsin Supreme Court.
Donovan has made crime his number one priority in the race. He's calling for more police officers and tougher penalties for criminals.
We have individuals in Milwaukee who behave badly, who behave in criminal ways, that are getting away with it because they feel there are no consequences for their actions.
Cavalier Johnson wants to bring back about 200 police officers that were cut in previous city budgets. Both candidates' call for more cops hasn't resonated with everyone. For the first time since its inception, political advocacy group Black Leaders Organizing Communities isn't endorsing a candidate. The group's political director, Kyle Johnson, says neither contender is good for black people.
We know after 2020, after however many past years, we know cops in the black community, the way the current system is set up, is not working.
Cavalier Johnson says he understands where the group is coming from, but residents want police protection. Still, he says police are only part of the solution to the city's public safety problems.
And so when I talk about public safety, I talk about it in a holistic way that includes police, yes, but it also includes positive reforms to the department. It also includes prevention. It also includes mental health.
Back at the Blue Kangaroo, Carla Fiera is looking for stabilization in her neighborhood. She has worked at the laundromat for 3 years and lives nearby.
I have been seeing too much difference between, you know, other neighborhoods than here in this community. It needs a lot of help.
The business community feels the same. Tim Sheehy heads the Milwaukee Chamber. He says people across the city want the same things: safety, prosperity, and educational opportunities.
And I think that that fundamentally covers every resident in the city of Milwaukee, whether they're here doing business, whether they're playing, whether they're living here, or whether they're passing through.
Sheehy says the election of a new mayor is exciting because it doesn't happen very often in Milwaukee. In the last 60 years, there have been 4 mayors. No matter how it turns out, it's a chance to look at the city's challenges in a new way. Corrine Hess, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up after the news, Wisconsin's nursing shortage isn't new, but the pandemic made it worse. We'll find out how bad it's gotten and what healthcare providers are trying to do about it. You can share your story right now. Email ideas@WPR.org, or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.